QED. Back to traffic, starting in Berkeley, Julie Deppish.
Yeah, a couple vehicles mixed it up. Westbound 80 after Ashby Avenue. They'll be in the second lane for the left. Backup starting at University Avenue. It's a solo spin out in Castro Valley and eastbound 580 after Redwood Road. That car into the center divide now. Making progress on this wreck, Palo Alto, North 101 before University Avenue. Couple vehicles, they're partially blocking the right lane. You'll be on the brakes around San Antonio Road. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Thank you so much, Julie, and we'll check in again with you in less than 20 minutes. Traffic support comes from visitors' coverage. Support for KQED comes from Supermicro and NVIDIA, accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise software platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations. On this Memorial Day, KQED News will bring us to the Lost Boat Ceremony that's coming up in moments. KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento. The time now is 6 o'clock.
Lightning is dangerous. So many people are doing barbecues today or cookouts, and lightning can actually jump more than 10 miles away from a thunderstorm.
Big storms are snarling traffic and flights this holiday weekend. What to watch for as they move east. It's Memorial Day, Monday, May 27th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Ahead this hour, new details on what really happened to a U.S. Navy ship that sank off the coast of Maine back in 1945.
There was no way that those boilers could have failed and caused the massive explosion that lifted the ship out of the water and broke it in two.
Also, we remember Disney songwriter Richard Sherman, the man responsible for the classic Mary Poppins earworm, Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
He just wanted to share everything and be part of it. The dearest man I've ever known.
Plus, what to watch for on the women's side as the French Open gets underway. Those stories and more after the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. International leaders are calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza today after the Gaza Health Ministry said an Israeli airstrike killed at least 45 Palestinians in a Rafah camp that was supposed to be a safe zone for people displaced by the war. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi has more.
The Israeli military came out today and said that they would carry out what they called a fact-finding mission to investigate the strike in Rafah. It also said that it, quote, regrets any harm to non-combatants during the war. And just to note, it's very unusual and maybe unprecedented in this war for Israel to so quickly publish an initial military inquiry into a civilian casualty event.
NPR's Adil Al-Shalchi reporting. This strike comes just days after the UN's International Court of Justice ordered an immediate halt to the Israeli operation in Rafah. President Biden marked Memorial Day at a solemn remembrance ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery. NPR's Anna Isaacs has more.
Beneath overcast skies, Biden called for a recommitment to freedom, democracy, opportunity, and equality. It will be 9 years this week since Biden lost his son, Beau, who served in Iraq and later died from brain cancer. The president attributes the illness to Beau Biden's time stationed near toxic burn pits.
The pain of his loss is with me every day as it is with you. Still sharp, still clear, but so is the pride I feel in his service, as if I can still hear him saying, "It's my duty, Dad, it's my duty."
The president also placed a wreath of flowers at the tomb of the unknown soldier, accompanied by Vice President Kamala Harris and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Anna Isaacs, NPR News.
A series of powerful storms that hit the central and southern U.S. this weekend has left at least 22 people dead, along with a trail of destroyed homes and businesses. Hundreds of thousands are without power across several states. Search and rescue operations are underway. Kentucky's governor declared a state of emergency, and in North Texas, cleanup is underway in Valley View, where at least seven people died in the storms. Elizabeth Myung with member station KERA has more.
Sammy Pons says he's grateful that he and his family weren't home when the storms hit, but when he returned on Sunday, his home was completely destroyed. He salvaged anything he could, clothing, pictures, valuables, but some things can't be replaced.
The most important thing that was going through my mind was, you know, all the memories that were here that were just gone in a few seconds.
Governor Greg Abbott says more than 200 homes and structures were destroyed in the storms. Of the victims who were killed, three were found dead in one home. Two victims were children ages 2 and 5. I'm Elizabeth Myong in Dallas.
U.S. futures contracts are trading flat at this hour. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQBD News, I'm Natalia Navarro. People around the Bay Area are remembering the late Bill Walton as an athlete, broadcaster, activist, author, and lover of iconic local bands like the Grateful Dead. Walton died today of cancer at the age of 71. The former UCLA basketball star was known for his love of California sports and the Pac-12 conference in particular, which he always referred to as the Conference of Champions. The conference played its last competitive event on Saturday. On this Memorial Day, Navy sailors who served on submarines and their families are remembering those who've died serving their country as part of San Francisco's annual Lost Boat Ceremony. KQED's Sarah Hosseini reports from Pier 45.
USS Bonefish, SS 223, lost 18 June 1945 with all hands, 85 men lost.
Gathered around the World War II era diesel submarine known as the USS Pampanito, dozens pay their respects to submariners who've gone on what they refer to as eternal patrol. They include Tom Swartz of San Francisco, who spent 3 decades working with Navy submarines.
I drew straws with another shipmate of mine. He was assigned to the fast attack submarine called the Scorpion, and it just didn't come back. So in honor of John Sweet, my old roommate, I'm here to pay the honors. And my family came with me.
They include his wife, grandson, and 2 adult sons who, like him, went on to serve, the oldest also on a submarine. I'm Sarah Hosseini, KQED News.
And I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from San Francisco Opera. The American premiere of Kaya Sarriaho's Innocence runs this June, sfopera.com. Support for NPR comes from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. Support for KQED comes from Leif Gebraser, Hyman & Bernstein, seeking justice for the injured victims of fraud, whistleblowers, employees, and investors in the Bay Area and nationally for over 5 decades. Online at lchb.com. And the listeners and supporters and members of KQED.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Nearly 2 dozen people are dead after a storm system ripped through much of the central United States over the weekend. Massive thunderstorms and tornadoes and hail the size of softballs. All this destroyed buildings. It took out power. And now that system is showering the East Coast. Here to tell us more about what has happened and what to expect, we have Matthew Cappucci, meteorologist with The Washington Post. Hey there.
Hey.
Hi. So I gather you have been taking all this in from Springfield, Missouri. You're out there tracking the storm. So let's start with the what happened. What happened?
Yeah, most definitely. So I've been in the field over the past month tracking tornadoes. I've tracked down 12 of them from close range, intercepting their paths. But in this case, so many of the tornadoes either occurred at night or were rain-wrapped, making it all the more difficult to not only see, but for people to shelter from, of course, because they kind of sneak up on them. We've had a multi-day storm system progress east across the United States. It began Saturday in Oklahoma, Kansas down towards Texas. There were overnight tornadoes in areas north of Dallas and near Tulsa. That moved east into Sunday, causing tornadoes across Missouri, over towards Kentucky, Tennessee as well. And now it's set to reach the eastern seaboard, hence the severe weather risk on this Memorial Day.
Is this kind of thing unusual for this time of year, late May?
Historically speaking, late May is the peak of severe weather season. You have summer's warmth trying to build in, so you have repeated rounds of warm, moist air rush north across the United States. It's like summer's trying to win. But winter is not quite ready to give up yet. There are still some pockets of cold air in the Rocky Mountains, and so periodic insurgences of cold air push east across the nation's heartland. That clash brews severe weather. But the issue, the jet stream, a river of very strong winds in the upper atmosphere, moves overhead and helps these storms to spin. So May is usually the perfect overlap of all of these parameters, and unfortunately, it can lead to some very damaging results.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, it looks like the intensity of these storms is easing a little as they're moving across the country. I mentioned they're moving east. What are we in for here on the East Coast?
On the East Coast, we've expected multiple MCSs, or mesoscale convective systems, basically big squall lines with a lot of lightning and wind, so winds gusting 50, 60 miles per hour in the strongest storms. There could be some quarter-sized hail in pockets, too. I think the tornado risk is lower, but not quite zero. Two different areas we're really watching for a potential isolated spin-up tornado, from like the Delmarva Peninsula towards New Jersey, and then a second area near the eastern Carolinas. But one thing I really want to emphasize, too, is lightning is dangerous. Yeah. So many people are doing barbecues today, or cookouts, or are at the beach, for example, and lightning can actually jump more than 10 miles away from a thunderstorm. So really, anytime you can hear thunder, you are close enough to be struck. And it's not just something we say. I mean, I myself have had many close calls with lightning. We really want folks to take it seriously today.
So what are we supposed to do? Remind us.
Anytime you hear thunder, you want to get to a good location inside and just kind of hunker down there until 30 minutes after the last rumble of thunder. Folks should have multiple ways to get notified. They should have, you know, wireless emergency alerts on their phone. They should tune into weather apps, anything they need to do to stay connected.
Okay, so you're telling me this is not shaped up to be an ideal day for picnics and gatherings on Memorial Day. What about travel? So many people are trying to get home after the long weekend. What should we be thinking about? How should we proceed if we're trying to get home?
I always tell folks not to drive in conditions they deem dangerous, whether that be heavy rain, whether that be wind, anything like that. If you see threatening clouds, don't be afraid to pull over. And I have to say, this month as a whole has been so incredibly active. So if it seems like the weather's been crazy, yes, everybody's tired, but we have just a little longer to go before the pattern finally settles down.
Matthew Cappucci, meteorologist with the Washington Post and the MyRadar app. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a small world, and a slightly less magical one, with the death of Disney songwriter Richard Sherman. It's a small world after all. He was one half of a songwriting duo with his brother, Robert. They were prolific, responsible for That Song, the hits from Mary Poppins, many other Disney musical favorites. Richard Sherman died over the weekend. He was 95. And joining me now for a remembrance is a longtime colleague of Sherman's, Thomas Schumacher, Chief Creative Officer of the Disney Theatrical Group. Tom, thanks for joining us.
I'm pleased to be able to talk about my dear friend.
Yeah.
Thank you for asking.
And
me.
I am sorry for the loss of your dear friend. I'm thinking you must have grown up, as many of us did, listening to Disney soundtracks. Would you just tell me, do you remember the first time you got to meet and work with Richard and Robert Sherman?
Well, sure. You know, the funny thing is because I grew up in California and I was born in the 50s, the Disney parks were a big part of my life, you know. So as children, you know, we'd all heard It's a Small World and, you know, the Tiki 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 Room and all these songs they wrote for the parks. In the tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki room. But, you know, I first encountered their music before I knew them, of course, through the parks, but also through the film Mary Poppins and its premiere engagement. Get this, 1964, Grauman's Chinese Theater. Everyone comes bouncing out of this joyful musical. My sisters are singing away. I'm 6 years old, and I'm singing Feed the Bird.
Come feed the little bird, show them.
The song filled with ennui, the touching, deeply moving, almost thematic song of Mary Poppins. But even as a child, they got right to my heart with Feed the Bird, you know?
Yeah.
And they're so well known for these bouncy songs, but that one just ripped me apart as a kid.
Yeah. Richard's older brother, Robert, Bob, died in 2012. I want you just to remind us what else, other highlights of their, I mean, pretty incredible catalog.
Oh my gosh. You know, when you think of the Sherman brothers, obviously Mary Poppins comes to mind first because they did write those indelible songs from the film. But I think a lot of people know them from, you know, even non-Disney stuff like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Which Richard always wanted credit for because he loves that. I mean, there's, it goes on and on and on. The Jungle Book sounds like I Want to Be Like You.
Oh, ooby-doo, ooby-doo, I want to be like you.
It goes on and on. Their work, some, I don't know, 200-300 songs for Disney, but it's over 1,000 songs when you start taking in all the stuff they wrote for everybody.
Wow. And they achieved success on all kinds of levels. They won an Oscar for Chim Chim Cheree.
Yeah.
And then, of all things, hit the Billboard charts, the Billboard Hot 100 in 1965 for Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
And also, You're 16, You're Beautiful in Your Mind.
Oh, yeah. So good.
You're 16, you're beautiful, and you're mine.
They wrote so much music, and they were very different guys. They're brothers, but they're separated, what, 3.5, almost 4 years apart in age. And they had very different youth. They grew up in Beverly Hills. Their dad, Al Sherman, was a popular songwriter himself. But Robert Sherman, Bob, you know, fought in World War II and went through a lot of trauma with that. And then Dick did service later, but by the time he was there, World War II was over. And so these two brothers who wrote the most beautiful family music ever had a deep, deep and complicated relationship.
Huh. I'm thinking that their collaboration and the things they both brought to that partnership helped. I mean, it helped Disney films become successful. You know, we know them for the animation, but so much of this was stories told in song. Is it fair to give these brothers credit for setting that standard, not just for Disney, but for so many animated features, stage adaptations that have come along since?
Well, sure. And it's hard to imagine Mary Poppins any other way as a film than what they created. But it's not just the songs on Poppins that they did. You know, Don DeGrady, who worked with them, and Robert and Richard really shaped that story and found the through line through it. They made a major character out of Bert, who you know is Dick Van Dyke, of course, in the movie. But those songs in Mary Poppins are proper big production numbers. It's not traditional. Film musicals tend to use songs to pepper the locales and stuff, but they were actually making a proper musical, like a Broadway style musical, but on film. And so they told the story in song. Right at the top of the movie, you meet the mother, played beautifully by Glynis Johns. Winifred comes out right away and sings Sister Suffragette, and we're in 1910 and women are fighting for the vote.
Well done, Sister Suffragette.
That was entirely an idea from the Sherman brothers. That's nothing to do with Pamela Travers.
We've been talking about their work and their music. Is there a story you would tell that would help us know Richard Sherman, the man, what he was like?
The curious thing about Richard was how he wore his heart so on his sleeve, you know, and he used to also say that he was a jukebox. Every time you'd ask stories, you know, you'd ask him anything and he'd tell you a story. And he began to joke he had so many of them, he could just say, you know, 14D. And the next story would come up like a jukebox because he had stories about Walt Disney. He had stories about Julie Andrews. He had stories about everybody he had worked with and always stories of extraordinary affection.
It sounds like he would have been a formidable competitor in certain categories of Trivial Pursuit. I wouldn't have wanted to face him.
He just wanted to share everything and be part of it. The dearest man I've ever known. Dearest man I've ever known.
Well, you know, I read a quote. This is from, 8 years ago. Richard Sherman talking about you, and he called you brilliant and said you were the only other person he knew who could juggle as much as Walt Disney himself. So it sounds like he was good about paying it forward as well.
I never heard that he said that. I'm overcome right now. That's really dear. He's so great, and he loved making things. He loved sitting down at the piano and putting his hands on it. He played in C. He wrote everything in C. And he would sit there at the piano and you just watch him make something magical. He was an open book about all that. So dear.
We've been speaking with Thomas Schumacher, Chief Creative Officer of Disney Theatrical Group, remembering the late songwriter, his friend, Richard Sherman. Thomas Schumacher, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered.
This is KQED Public Radio. We got your traffic information now. We're going to start in San Jose, saying hello to Julie Deppish.
And we do have a closure here in San Jose, northbound and southbound 880. The off-ramps to Montague Expressway are shut down for an accident investigation, so CHP has issued a traffic alert for that. Should be close to clearing this wreck, Palo Alto, North 101 before University Avenue. It's been in the right lane a while, so slow from Oregon Expressway. And better news, Berkeley, that crash clear from 80 westbound after Ashby Avenue. Looking better from University Avenue. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Thank you, Julie. And we'll talk to Julie again in about 10 minutes. Support for KQED comes from Sutter Health, with birth centers that never stop delivering joy and cancer clinical trials that never stop delivering hope. Sutter never stops caring for Californians at all stages of life. Learn more at SutterHealth.org. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, introducing the all-electric EV6 with a vehicle-to-load function that turns the EV6 into a mobile power source. More info at kia.com. Well, as South Africa faces a political turning point, All Things Considered brings you a story about Nelson Mandela's early involvement with the ANC, the African National Congress. That story is coming up next. And then at 6:30...
Customer service calls are often answered by somebody on the other side of the planet. Now, apply that concept to retail. Outsourcing cashiers next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace at 6:30. Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement designed by gastroenterologists to help relieve occasional bloating, gas, and abdominal discomfort. More at alignprobiotics.com.
Sitting in the morning sun.
Stax Records, the Memphis soul label that produced hits by Otis Redding, Booker T and the MGs, Sam and Dave, Isaac Hayes, and others, is now the subject of a four-part documentary series on HBO Max. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from some of the musicians behind the music. Guitarist Steve Cropper, Booker T, and Isaac Hayes.
Watching the tide.
Coming up at 7 o'clock here on KQED.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. South Africans go to the polls on Wednesday, and the country is facing a turning point. The ANC, the African National Congress, has been in power for the last 30 years, ever since Nelson Mandela took office as the country's first black president. Increasingly, though, that power is being challenged, and across the political spectrum, people are trying to claim Mandela's legacy as their own. Rund Abdel Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei, co-hosts of NPR's history show Throughline, bring us a story about Mandela's early involvement with the ANC and the choices he made in his fight for freedom.
Nelson Mandela was in his 20s when he joined the ANC, a political organization that advocated for the rights of black South Africans. At the time, the system was dominated by white South Africans, many of whom were the descendants of Dutch colonists known as Afrikaners. And within just a few years, the stakes of this political fight got much higher.
We can act in only one of two directions. Either we must follow the course of equality, which must eventually mean national suicide for the white race, or we must take the course of separation. Daniel Francois Malan.
In 1948, a new exclusively Afrikaner government led by Prime Minister Daniel Francois Malan came to power in South Africa and put in place a new policy called apartheid.
Apartheid shaped every part of life for black and white South Africans, as well as the small but significant populations of mixed-race, quote, colored and Indian people, whose ancestors were often brought to South Africa as slaves and indentured servants.
Black people were removed from their homes and forced to live either in urban townships, often without electricity or municipal services, or rural areas called Bantustans that were overcrowded and impoverished.
Society was completely segregated. If you were black, colored, or Indian, you needed a passbook to travel into any white area, and there was a strict censorship of the media.
Faced with this escalating prejudice, Mandela and other young members of the ANC teamed up to create the ANC Youth League.
These are young people who start to say, we need to change the strategy.
This is Tsepo Moloi. He's a lecturer in the history department at the University of Johannesburg.
We need to be more confrontational now.
Their stance earned them the nickname, the Young Lions. They launched what was called the Defiance Campaign.
The laws that they defied was to walk into white areas without permission.
He said, I violated the laws, but the laws themselves are unjust.
This is Richard Stengel. Alongside Mandela, he wrote Long Walk to Freedom, the autobiography of Nelson Mandela.
The laws themselves should be on trial.
On the 21st of March, 1960,
activists go on a march in a place called Sharpeville.
The group of people who lived in Sharpeville went to the police station to hand their passports and be arrested. The police opened fire on the people, the crowd which was there.
69 people were killed, most of them shot in the back.
And scores of others were injured.
The South African government declared a state of emergency 9 days after the massacre and banned the ANC and another black liberation organization called the Pan-Africanist Congress, who had organized the Sharpeville protests.
Mandela began to think that nonviolent protest wasn't going to overturn apartheid. And Mandela then became the founder of Umkhonto we Sizwe, Spear of the Nation, which was the military wing of the ANC. Even though Mandela, he abhorred violence morally, his goal, to which everything was subordinate, was freedom for my people, one person, one vote. When I asked him about the turn, the embrace of violence, he said,
the strategy I would use would depend on the conditions. That's why we resorted to violence, for example, because the conditions demanded that we should take up arms.
Almost in these words, for Gandhi, nonviolence was a moral principle.
Gandhi would never have agreed.
For me, it was a tactic, and when a tactic is not working, you change it. He thought this was a way of putting more pressure on the government, and perhaps getting more international support. And that was more his goal than overturning the state or defeating the very powerful South African military.
Which was getting support and weaponry from the West, including the U.S., who saw the South African government as an ally in its Cold War against communism.
Meanwhile, the ANC and its members were considered an enemy in that war because of their links to the Soviet Union and their new willingness to engage in violence. Mandela was placed on the U.S. terrorism watch list.
Mandela then shortly thereafter went underground and he started to build a guerrilla movement.
It happened on a Thursday. Acting on a tip from an informant, the police raided a farm where an underground militia was believed to be plotting a violent insurrection against the government. 19 people were arrested.
At the time, Nelson Mandela was already serving a short stint in prison on a separate charge. But the evidence the government gathered in the raid was enough to bring him to trial for treason and sabotage. The stakes for Mandela were life or death.
The accused deliberately and maliciously plotted and engineered the commission of acts of violence and destruction throughout the country. Their combined operations were planned to lead to confusion, violent insurrection, and rebellion.
In 1964, after this trial, Nelson Mandela was sentenced to life in prison. For years, he was labeled by the state as prisoner 46664. But eventually, against all odds, in 1994, he transformed from South Africa's number one terrorist into South Africa's first black president, ushering in a new era of democracy.
That was Throughline hosts Ramtin Arablouei and Rund Abdel Fattah. And you can hear the whole episode by finding Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This story from Throughline comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Marketplace awaits here on KQED Public Radio, but let's take a look at traffic in Oakland. Julie Depesh.
We're heading southbound on Highway 13 at Broadway Terrace. There's a downed motorcycle in the right lane, the off-ramp blocked here, and a car involved is on the right-hand shoulder. Traffic heavy back to the 24 interchange. Got a wreck on the San Mateo Bridge, eastbound 92 after midspan. That's a car and an SUV. They made it to the center divide. Be careful driving in San Jose and the Guadalupe Parkway, southbound before Julian Street. There's a bumper in the middle lane. Julie Depesh for KQED.
Thank you, Julie. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from, well, Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all on the web at theschmidt.org. And KQED's Bay Curious podcast, sponsored by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, features fun trivia questions at the end of each episode. You can listen to test your Bay Area knowledge and enter to win cool prizes at kqed.org/baycurious. Time now, 6:30.
Marketplace is supported by Crowley, a logistics, energy, and maritime solutions company with nearly 135 years of innovation and a commitment to sustainability. Learn more at crowley.com.
Coming up on the show today, a bright spot for manufacturing, why your morning coffee is getting more expensive, and the rise of the Zoom cashier. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance. Customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto. Learn more about bundling at progressive.com. And by Ninja One, the endpoint management platform that automates the hardest parts of IT and helps your employees be more productive and secure no matter where they work at ninjaone.com.
In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, May 27th. Good to have you with us. We're going to start today with some economic news you might have missed going into the Memorial Day weekend, a sign of a rebound in U.S. manufacturing. The Commerce Department said Friday that new orders for durable goods rose 0.7% in April from the month before. That's the third increase in a row. And one particular line item caught our attention, what's known as core capital goods. Those orders were up 0.3% month to month. Economists like to look at this measure as an indication of what businesses are planning to produce in the future. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
Core capital goods are things that help businesses produce more things. Not only were new orders for these up for the month, says Bank of America economist Stephen Juneau, they were also up 1.2% year over year.
So I think that's a good sign that businesses are starting to kind of invest again.
Juneau says last year, with money from the Inflation Reduction and Chips and Science Acts, there was a lot of investment in structures, such as factories and warehouses, but not as much on equipment.
So we built these warehouses, and now maybe we're starting to see those warehouses get stocked with machinery. You need that machinery ultimately to make those warehouses make goods.
Juneau points out some of the rise in spending likely reflects an increase in prices for that machinery. But John Diamond, a fellow at Rice University's Baker Institute, says this is still a positive sign for future production. And?
It's also a positive for bringing inflation down.
Diamond explains if manufacturers invest more in equipment and then produce more goods,
then consumers will have more choices. There won't be as much competition for a smaller number of goods, and it'll restrain price increases.
Diamond says that these numbers are often revised substantially, so he takes them not just with a grain of salt, but a few shakes of the salt shaker. And nationwide economist Oren Klatchkin points out high interest rates continue to make it pricey for business to borrow to buy expensive equipment. Also,
the ability to access that money through the banking system is fairly limited because bank lending standards are still relatively tight.
Klatchkin points out that these purchases are some of the most expensive a company will make, and they don't buy a giant machine or a truck just because they'll be able to use it next month. They buy it because they'll be able to use it for the next decade. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
U.S. markets were closed today, but we'll have some holiday-related numbers for you when we get there. Mexico City is in the middle of a water crisis after an extended drought. The largest city in North America may soon run out of water in several key reservoirs. Some experts predict this could happen as early as June, which some have taken to calling day zero. Caroline Hauck is a senior editor of news for Vox, where she wrote about water shortages in Mexico City, among other places. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Caroline, can you describe the situation briefly in Mexico City? How did it get so bad?
Yeah, so Mexico City right now is staring down a pretty acute water crisis. There's a couple acute factors here. There's been abnormally low rainfall for a long time. And some of that is exacerbated by current phenomena like of this year, things like El Nino, the weather phenomena that's causing droughts across the region. But in other ways, this is a much more structural kind of systemic issue. When the Spaniards arrived on the continent, they drained the lakes on which the city was built. And so all of the impervious surfaces that have been built on top of those don't really allow for the rainwater that does fall to replenish the aquifers that provide actually the vast bulk of Mexico City's water. And then there's also some particular issues with the water infrastructure itself. Mexico City, by some estimates, loses about 40% of its water that does enter its system, whether it's through leaky pipes or being stolen. And then all of this is also being exacerbated by climate change, making these droughts worse and more unpredictable.
And you write that this isn't just happening in Mexico City. Where else are people facing water shortages right now?
I think that's like what really struck me that when I got into this and why I was interested in this piece is I remember visiting Cape Town right around when they had their own day zero water crisis back in the 2010s. Right. And to your point, it's not just Mexico City right now. So right now we have El Nino exacerbating droughts throughout Latin America. Bogota, Colombia has been rationing water for a month now, I believe. Early on, the president, Gustavo Petro, even told people, I think semi-jokingly, I hope, to leave the city and drink water elsewhere just because the system was so strapped. The Panama Canal, this lifeline of international commerce, is having to restrict transit through because drought has brought down the canal levels too low. I'm sure you're familiar with like the Colorado River in the U.S. is over-indexed and over-allocated, and it's causing issues across the American Southwest. So this is not the issue of one city. This is the issue of like how we treat water in the 21st century.
You mentioned Cape Town, South Africa, which got dangerously close to day zero back in 2018. How did they end up surviving that crisis?
Yeah, so I think there's a little bit of hope and there's a little bit of like pessimism here in that the idea of this day zero campaign really kind of launched a lot in South Africa during the time. It was launched as this kind of awareness campaign to get people to reduce consumption, and that awareness campaign helped extend the runway. But as an expert told my colleagues over on the Today Explain podcast, what really ultimately like helped in South Africa is that it rained.
Right.
And we can't always count on the rain. So I think we need to make systemic changes, or at least that's what the experts I spoke to said, that we need to really rethink how we manage water as a resource.
Yeah, I mean, Mexico City is also counting on rains coming, hopefully next month. But what other options does the city have?
Yeah, so I think there's like the short-term ones that maybe you're already thinking of from what I said previously. You can fix these leaky pipes. Like if you're saving 40% of water, that's a big difference if you're counting the days down before there's no water at all. But ultimately, like a lot of this, what needs to happen is also rethinking not just the way we manage water, but also some experts said rethinking the way we grow our cities, making it more possible for the aquifers we all rely upon to replenish and to avoid these kind of boom bust cycles where you get an intense rainstorm and everything floods. And instead of it all percolating down and being there for the long term for the city residents, it just floods out and rushes out to the rivers and the sea.
When I've reported on water issues, I've heard over and over again that water is too cheap. in other words, especially for the biggest users like agriculture, the price doesn't reflect the actual cost of that water. And if we had to pay that cost, maybe we'd do a better job of conserving as a society. Are you hearing that as well?
Yeah, so I actually heard like kind of an interesting discussion in the different academics I spoke to about this. I'm personally still torn. I'm not gonna endorse any side, but I saw like one person told me about the good that's being done by charging industry in American cities for their wastewater, their sewage, their runoff, and how that's incentivizing them to think more creatively about, instead of just using water once through a system, can they reuse it multiple times? And that sounded really convincing to me. I've also talked to people who say, look, like this is fundamentally like a human right. And when we're talking about water and urban environments, treating it as a commodity can lead to gross inequities. I'm not sure exactly what the answer is, but I think there is like a rich discussion there about the best ways to treat this.
Yeah, and one thing I've heard is priced appropriately for people who can pay and subsidized for those who can't. So
yeah, and I think that's one of the things that really jumps out to me also about Mexico City right now is the way this is exacerbating inequality, right? Like there's obvious tensions around who does get water, whose pipes regularly work, but also when they don't work, who has the money to pay for that increasingly expensive use of water.
Caroline Houck is a senior editor at Vox and runs the morning news letter there, Today Explained. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to hear more about how parts of the United States are dealing with water scarcity, we have a whole season about it on the podcast I host, How We Survive. You can find it at marketplace.org or your preferred podcast app. Four years after the pandemic started, what initially looked like a COVID-related surge in people starting businesses now looks more like a long-term change. Census data shows that a record 5.5 million people filed applications for new businesses last year. So what's it like to be on the ground in those early days of a new business? Marketplace's Maria Hollenhorst spent a day with one entrepreneur in Phoenix, Arizona.
Picture this. It's 10 a.m. on a Sunday in late February, and about a dozen or so wedding vendors, that's florists, photographers, even musicians, are setting up booths and tables in an outdoor picnic area. There are trees, balloons, and lacy tablecloths.
I'm doing a booth just with hand-painted wine glasses.
I own a photo booth company. This is one of my booths.
And we're a home studio florist out of Surprise, Arizona.
That's Susie May, Ayanna Brown, and Wendy Harris. And then, just minutes before the event's official start time, one more vendor showed up.
Oh, I'm so sorry. It took us so long. Oh, my God.
Taylor Nasiah Jenkins, who goes by Nessie, launched a vintage boutique a few months ago called House of Vestige.
We're just setting up, so we decided that we're just going to do a clothing, like a rack today instead of a whole table.
Nessie is wearing a white satin dress, pink lip gloss, and shiny gold earrings. Her boyfriend is helping her hang skirts and dresses on mismatched hangers. Most cost her less than $80.
So it's all secondhand vintage. I use eBay a lot, Poshmark. I go to thrift stores. And most of the stuff is, I've only brought my bridal stuff today because this is a bridal show. And
Nessie is 24 years old. I first spoke to her 2 years ago, not long after she'd left the Bay Area, where she grew up in search of more affordable housing.
Like, I knew nothing about Arizona, but I just knew, like, what I wanted, I wouldn't be able to get in California.
She's moved around a lot and is still trying to find her place in the economy. And by place, I mean the right job.
3 restaurant jobs. I was an office manager for an acupuncture office. I worked for the Maricopa County School District. I was a substitute. I've been a nanny. I've been
a lot of jobs. While we wait for the first customers to arrive, Nessie tells me about her reasons for trying to start something of her own.
Being in the workforce as a young Black woman has been, I don't even know to say, like, hard. That's not even, like, fitting enough. Every Black woman that I know, their struggle with the workforce is literally exhausting. If someone is in a disagreement with you, or someone said, you say something that someone doesn't like, is you'll be called aggressive, or you're made out to be an aggressor. So you literally go about the world in such a different way.
Black business ownership right now is growing faster than it has in 30 years. According to the Small Business Administration, the share of Black households that own a business more than doubled between 2019 and 2022. But reality check, government data shows that roughly 1 in 5 new businesses do not survive their first year. Nessie's still just getting started, but dreams of eventually opening a physical store.
Honestly, if I never make $1 million off of it, I'm okay with that because it's what I'm passionate about.
She spent about $1,500 and countless hours trying to get this boutique off the ground, sourcing inventory, setting up a website, coordinating photo shoots.
I've had a photo shoot where literally all the models said they couldn't come the same day. I've had a photo shoot where the photographer said the same day, like, she couldn't come. Like, it's been hard.
And she's been to a handful of events like this one, where 2.5 hours in, there are still no customers.
It's a lot harder than I thought it would be. Yeah.
Entrepreneurship is hard. Nessie said the only reason she's even able to try is because her boyfriend helped support her financially.
If my partner wasn't making as much as he does at his job, I wouldn't be able to. So it is a privilege to be able to say that.
This event lasted for 4 hours, and not a single customer came. Nessie bought something, though.
I'll just take this out, and I'll give you the 20.
Okay. A few champagne glasses to use for photo shoots.
Thank you so much.
That was a few months ago. In the time since, she's gone to a couple more events, even attempted a fashion show, but reframed it as a photo shoot when not enough people came. Nessie wants to make this business work, but for now at least, she's keeping her day job as a nanny. I'm Maria Hollenhorst for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So she looks, you know, like any cashier you might see, but she's just not physically there.
So where is she? But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed for the Memorial Day holiday. If you're traveling this weekend, you may have noticed gas prices held steady. According to AAA, the average cost for a gallon of gas nationally was $3.61. Anyone traveling by air could find long security lines. The Transportation Security Administration screened a record 2,951,163 people on Friday at the start of the holiday weekend. Memorial Day, of course, marks the unofficial start of summer and the time when many teenagers look for jobs. The outplacement firm Challenger, Gray & Christmas is predicting teens will pick up 1.3 million jobs between May and July, the largest number in 4 years, thanks to consumer demand and teens' desire to work. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, a nonpartisan organization dedicated to raising awareness and accelerating action on America's fiscal challenges to build a brighter economic future for the next generation. Learn more at pgpf.org. And by Amazon Business, helping provide a smarter, easier way to get the supplies businesses need to thrive. Amazon Business, your partner for smart business buying.
Support for KQED comes from the 10th Anniversary Bay Area Book Festival, June 1st and 2nd, with Naomi Klein, Viet Thanh Nguyen, Alki Joshi, Joan Baez, and more. Books galore and fun for all, baybookfest.org. And UCSF Health, collaborating with Marin Health in the North Bay to deliver exceptional orthopedic care, including surgical and non-surgical options for spine conditions. UCSFHealth.org/Marin Health. On Shifting Ground tonight with your host, Ray Suarez. Considering the future of Iran, the president just died in a helicopter crash May 19th. What does the death of Ibrahim Raisi mean for the country and the rest of the Middle East? And a conversation with former U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. That's on Shifting Ground tonight at 10 and again at 1 a.m. on KQED.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Okay, be honest. How many cups of coffee have you had today? I mean, I'm barely functional until at least one cup in. The National Coffee Association says more Americans drink coffee each day, almost two-thirds of us, than any other beverage, even plain old water. And that habit, you've probably noticed, is getting more expensive. The cost of a popular variety of coffee bean recently touched its highest level since the 1970s. Marketplace's Lily Jamali hit her local coffee shop in Los Angeles to find out why.
My go-to coffee order is a 16-ounce soy latte.
Can I get an extra shot?
What? I'm working the holiday. My order costs $7.20, not cheap. Far from here, way higher up the supply chain, the price of coffee benchmark Robusta hasn't been this high in 45 years.
The raw commodity, the crop has been coming in very weak.
Professor Chris Barnett at Cornell says climate change has a lot to do with that. Robusta is the basis for espresso and instant coffee. Vietnam and Brazil are its top growers, and right now, both are experiencing drought.
There's just much less available, so roasters have been bidding up the price.
That shortage comes as coffee consumption is growing around the world, says Spencer Tour of the consultancy Coffee Enterprises.
It's not just the North American consumer. It's not just the European consumer.
Take China, where major coffee retailers have expanded in recent years, and discounts and coupons have helped that market grow. This squeeze in supply and growing demand has helped push the price of beans 20% higher so far this year, says Michael Hallin of Bloomberg Intelligence.
But that's not going to show up, you know, at the store level right away.
A company buying big volumes like Starbucks locks in purchase prices ahead of time.
They're securing pretty significant amounts of coffee 12 to 18 months in advance.
Even when higher costs are passed on to the consumer, you might not notice. It turns out that makes up just a small fraction of what your local coffee shop charges. My $7 is mostly going to processors, wholesalers, retailers, and transporting those beans. It's enough to make you want to switch to tea. In Los Angeles, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
The idea of offshoring, moving parts of a company's business overseas to take advantage of lower costs, might make you think of assembly lines in China or manufacturers in Vietnam. And that still happens, obviously. But thanks to AI and other tech, we may be entering a new age of digital offshoring. Wizzy Kim wrote about it at Vox, where she's a senior reporter. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we got to start with this chicken shop that you visited in the East Village in New York City. Sansan Chicken, am I saying it right?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, so tell us about the customer experience there.
So I walked in on a Wednesday afternoon. The shop wasn't super busy. And the first thing that I see when I walk in is there isn't a physical cashier. It's a screen with a cashier over Zoom. She's wearing a headset. She looks, you know, like any cashier you might see, but she's just not physically there. She's potentially thousands of miles away.
Wow. And I mean, the first question I ask, of course, is why? Why is there a Zoom cashier?
I think that's a great question. So these cashiers are hired by a company called Happy Cashier. And the founder of the company has sort of said, well, first of all, you know, we're trying to just experiment with it and see how it goes. But also, I can't deny that it is much cheaper to hire someone in the Philippines to be a cashier than it would be to hire a cashier in New York City.
Right. So this is another form of offshoring. I mean, we're familiar with a lot of customer service being, you know, offshore and call centers. But how is this the sign of what you think of as a new era of digital offshoring?
Well, I think that technology and specifically the adoption of technology within an industry has for a long time come with this sort of outsourcing or offshoring. So this often happens because the technology can sort of be used to enable some of the geographical constraints of work to disappear. So people all over the world can do it. And if given the chance, a lot of companies do that.
Can you give some other examples of newer forms this is taking?
Sure. So for example, Amazon's grocery stores used to have, up until very recently, a technology called Just Walk Out, where you don't have to go to the till and check out your items. You could just walk out with whatever you want to buy, and it would just automatically know which items you had. But then it turned out that oftentimes those transactions needed to be verified or validated by a whole mass of human workers, many of them in India, very far away from, you know, the Amazon grocery stores physically located in the U.S.
Right. And you talk about the emergence of so-called digital sweatshops. I mean, these jobs tend to be pretty low paid. What do we know about the working conditions for these tech workers who are doing the behind the scenes work that we attribute to automation?
You know, it's an industry that we now call click work because a lot of it is done through the computer, but it's also very low paying in that each individual task might not take too long. So they pay, you know, like literal pennies for each task. And you're supposed to amass as many of these tasks as you can. But you work a full day doing all these digital tasks, and you might still be making less than minimum wage in that country. And sometimes the nature of the work might be just traumatic, as with content moderation. All the workers have talked about just being really mentally disturbed, understandably so, by the nature of the work that they have to do.
In your piece, you talk about how workers have responded to technological disruption in the past, going back to the Luddites destroying machines that they thought threatened their textile jobs. How are workers generally responding to these new technologies now?
I think that there is more wariness over how things like AI could be used against workers, especially among creative jobs. So for example, with the Writers Guild of America last year, during the Hollywood strike, AI was one of the central components of, you know, what they were bargaining for. They didn't want AI to be credited as a writer. They didn't want AI created writing to be used as source materials. And in the case of like click work and AI training, a lot of the jobs are sort of what's considered gig work today. They're not considered employees. They don't get all of the labor protections that employees of a more traditional employment model would get. Often automation and the degradation of labor comes for work that is already pretty vulnerable to this sort of worsening.
All right. Wizzy Kim wrote about the future of work and digital offshoring at Vox. Thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Betterment, the automated investing platform that helps make it easy to be invested for the long term. Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. And by Million Bazillion, a podcast from Marketplace that makes it fun and easy for parents to teach their kids about money. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.
This final note on the way out today, the first cruise ships to set sail here in Baltimore since the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge left the port this weekend. Royal Caribbean's Vision of the Seas departed Saturday for a five-night voyage to Bermuda, followed by Carnival Pride, which started a trip to Canada and Greenland yesterday. More than 400,000 cruise passengers came through the Port of Baltimore last year. The Army Corps of Engineers now expects to restore the port's main channel for normal shipping traffic by June 10th. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Elise Hassan, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow.